Hello and welcome to another episode of the Halloween Podcast. I am your host, Lyle Perez. On this episode, we are going into part two of our War of the World discussion. And I have Kat with me. Kat, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. So just a quick briefer. Why don't you go ahead and tell us who you are again?
I am Kat. I have the podcast Haunting History Podcast. You can listen to that on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Awesome. So we are going straight into our part two discussion on War of the Worlds. This is the actual broadcast itself. So we're going to get into the broadcast now. We know Welles had many actors, and he even had an orchestra with him. Was he the biggest name there? Who else was there?
I don't think that he was the biggest name, not at 23 years old. I mean, he was building his reputation at the time. But the actors that were there, and I can tell you who they were. Some of them were some of the biggest names in vaudeville. They had, one of the actors was Kenny Delmar. He was an American actor. He was in radio, films, animation. He was one of the pioneering radio announcers on the March of Time, which was a national radio sensation in 1945. Well, after this, but it made him famous. There was an American director, actor, writer, Richard Wilson. Ray Collins was an American character actor from Broadway, which I think is amazing that he had moved to radio. Let's see who else there was. Stefan Schnabel. He was a German-born American actor who worked in theater, radio, films, and television. Howard Smith was an American character actor with a 50-year career in vaudeville, theater, radio, films. He went on to films and television. He worked a lot with Orson Welles. Orson Welles tended to keep the same people around. You'll notice that in any of his shows and stuff, you'll recognize some of the same people over and over again. Sort of like a boys' club.
Right, yeah. They got to keep those people together. They had a lot of names. A lot of these people did a lot of different characters in the show. Orson Welles did a couple of characters. Kenny Del Mar, he did quite a few characters. But the cool thing is...
He did.
The cool thing
Kenny
is...
Kenny Del Mar was interesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can't tell these people are the same people. Like, you can listen to them and you would not know that they're the same people. They can change their voice that much.
Except for Orson Welles. Did you... Orson Welles was the narrator,
Yeah.
And then he was also the professor.
Yes, Orson Welles has that...
He has such a distinctive voice.
Yes, I was just about to say that. You can tell his voice by the way he talks. Every time I hear another radio program called The Shadow, I can tell when it's Welles, when he's The Shadow, because of the voice.
Right, isn't that crazy? But Kenny Del Mar was probably... Well, he was a character actor, too, so he changed... He changed often, even in films and television later on. But in this episode, he played the captain of the Signal Corps. He also played the policeman at the farm. And he played the Secretary of the Interior, which I did quotes in the air. You can't see, but he, who was supposedly the Secretary of the Interior, was supposed to be a real person in the government speaking.
Right, yeah. A lot of these people are the same ones. You would have never known it. I mean, I just realized that not too long ago that a lot of these people were the same exact actors.
Yeah, and they do. Again, they follow him around and do a bunch of different things with him. So he finds his talent in people that he respected and thought were really good at their craft. And that's what was one of the brilliant things about Orson Welles. He was very good at recognizing talent.
Yeah, that's one of the good things about him. I mean, he was a very talented himself, too.
Brilliant. 100%. Definitely a brilliant, brilliant actor and brilliant director. And he knew what people wanted.
Yeah. Oh,
and he knew
boy,
how to
did he.
Deliver it.
So we know that things were recorded live. What was the recording schedule like?
For any of the radio programs, they would usually do a rehearsal either the day before or the morning of. Just one rehearsal. And then they would... go live that night. It wasn't something that they, unless it was something big, they didn't have numerous rehearsals like a Broadway play does or even a local playhouse play. They would do a run through slash rehearsal and then record that evening or the next evening.
Yeah, these things go by pretty fast. You'd be surprised. I learned recently that one of my favorite old-time radio shows, the Hall of Fantasy, Richard Thorne did all of the writing. He did a lot of the announcing and a lot of stuff like that. And his turnaround time was the next day.
I know. We think podcasts are so hard. Like, we do, you know, podcasts like once a week or whatever, and we're trying to scramble and get our information every week and make sure we've done enough research. They were doing stuff in 24 hours.
Yes, the same day. They wrote it in the morning, and they were on it at night. And I was holy smokes. There's no way I'd be able to do that.
No, you'd be exhausted all the time.
I'm exhausted doing 31 shows in 31 days.
Yes, I can't even imagine what you're doing right now. And they did it for a living. They did it day in, day out, years and years and years. And but brilliant people, though. I mean, I don't know that the talent that we have nowadays compares to the talent and the drive that they had back in the day.
Yeah, I know. Penn and Teller, or actually Penn, said it best when he said that people in show business are the most weakest people in the world.
I don't think back then, though. I mean, I think definitely now, but back then, they were made up out of your stock, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, Penn couldn't do his radio show anymore because he said that doing his nightly show at the Rio kind of drained him the rest of the day, so he couldn't do anything else other than an hour of show.
Oh, goodness.
Like, such a wimp.
That, for sure. I mean, can you just imagine back then they were, and very rare was someone, any one of these actors that we named that were in the broadcast on October 30th, 1938, that wasn't their only gig. They had come probably from there in the day where they recorded something else. So they were bouncing around from studio to studio, and that's how they made their money. They didn't have the giant paychecks that they get now.
I know, and imagine if they got sick. That means they wouldn't be able to go to work.
Right.
Their whole world revolves around the voice.
And if you didn't go to work, you didn't get to pay your rent, so.
And then the depression happened. See, I just figured out exactly what happened in the Great Depression.
There you go, exactly.
Voice actors. But yeah. So I'm not sure everyone was listening to the broadcast. So how did things spread? Because not a lot of people were tuning in to this thing. How did the word spread? Hey, you got to turn into this channel. Without like any real like telephones or the internet as what we have
now.
Well,
they did have telephones. So a lot of people did. I read some firsthand accounts of people who were children at the time were telling the story of how their aunt called their mom and said, turn on CBS. And so, I mean, I definitely think the phone lines. And at one point there was an issue with the phone lines because so many people were on the phones. It's not like today. And a lot of times where they indicated, and I'm saying that purposely for a discussion later, where they indicated that most of the panic was were in not farms that were spread out by a couple miles per house. It was the tall buildings with apartments where people were knocking on each other's door and saying, are you listening to CBS? Are you listening to CBS? So it was more in the densely populated areas that they implied that the panic had happened.
Oh, yeah. And I just want to make it clear. I meant to say texting, not the telephone. I obviously knew the telephone was around. I was thinking texting.
But you know what? A lot of people, after the Great Depression, a lot of people did not have phones.
Right. They were returning them back to the stores.
Yeah. It was definitely an expense that people couldn't afford. But that was one of the ways that the perceived panic did grow, was because people were calling people to tune in.
Man, what a time that was.
Much nicer. I feel like maybe I was born in the wrong era.
You too. I kind of feel that sometimes. Every time I look at like old coffee commercials where there's like a group of people just huddling inside a living room, chit-chatting, talking with a big old thing of coffee in front of them, I'm like, man, that seems like fun to me.
Yeah, I feel like I was supposed to be there. I don't know that I was supposed to sit in a room with a bunch of people staring at their phones.
Exactly. But here we are podcasting. It's kind of like we're doing that, but without coffee.
Yeah, hypocrites, right? I know. But I believe that podcasting is sort of history repeating itself. Podcasting is not much different than the old-time radio shows.
It's not. I mean, people, I always say, if you know me personally, I'm not much of a talker. I don't talk to people. I like to listen. I'm a listener. I am the person, if there's a group of three, I am the one person not really saying much, but listening to those two talk. And that's probably why I like podcasts so much, is because I don't have to talk. I just have to sit there and listen to these two talk, or these three talk. So doing a show like this kind of takes me out of the bubble, but it's you know, it's being the host, I have to talk, so I'm talking.
Well, and I'm probably the polar opposite. I don't think I've ever met a stranger. I talk to everyone. But I think that people say that podcasts are so popular because everybody wants to multitask now. You don't want to sit in front of a television because you can't be doing three other things while you're watching TV. Where if you listen to podcast, you can do your housework, you can work on your car, you can wash your car, you can bathe the dog and still be listening to a podcast. And I don't necessarily believe that's the truth, although as I say that, I do hear myself being sort of hypocritical, because I tend to listen to most podcasts while I'm at work doing other things. But I think it also takes us back to sort of a simpler place where not every one of your senses is being overloaded. Like if you're watching a movie and it's the sound and the vision and everything else, podcasting is just hearing, and you can let your imagination get lost in the story. Yes. And I think that maybe the world is going back to a simpler time. I mean, maybe it's wishful thinking, but old time radio shows were not that different than what we're doing now with podcasting.
That is one of the main reasons why I decided to do Lyle's Mystery Theater, was because I love old time radio shows. I love being able to use your imagination to put these things together. And I wanted to share that with other people, because I felt like old time radio shows, yeah, it's getting popular, but more people could be enjoying them because they're free. You get them from the public domain. There's no copyright in any of these things. It was before copyright was even a thing. So you can freely download them. If you want to pay for, you know, a CD that has a bunch of them already connected, go right ahead, buy the CD. I bought tons of CDs that have big collections of them already done. I don't have to scatter 30 different websites to find them. And another reason why I wanted to do it so bad was because I joke with my wife, I have terrible eyesight, and I always tell her there's probably a reason why I love old-time radio shows so much. It's because I like my future me is kind of projecting itself to my present me and telling me, one day you're going to go blind and the only thing you're going to really be able to enjoy is listening. Yeah. That's why I love listening.
Well, I hope listening. That doesn't happen
to you. I hope not too, but I mean, it's just my brain coming up with weird things. I'm a writer, so my brain's always coming up with weird things. and I'm like, yeah, one day I'm going to be blind and the only thing I'm going to be able to listen to is old-time radio shows. So I have to love them now, because then when I'm older, it's going to be a breeze listening to them.
Well, it really is a lost art. If you listen to my favorite old radio shows are the comedies, and they didn't have visual effects to make themselves funny. They projected funny with just their voices. And I just think it's amazing. And the talent that was involved in that is something to respect. And I think that a lot of people would probably enjoy them a lot more than they think that they would.
Oh, nice. Do you ever listen to The Red Skeleton?
I did. One of my very favorite podcasts is The Red Skeleton Christmas Story.
Did you know that I drive by his ranch every single day?
Do you really?
Yes, I do. He used to live in my old town, the town that I live in Anza. He has a ranch up there. He had a ranch. He passed away.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, it was for sale not too long ago. They sold it. I drive by all the time.
Have you ever heard his story, The Christmas Tree?
Mm-mm.
Oh my gosh, you have to find it. It is probably it's the one story that I think made me fall in love with old radio shows. I mean, my dad loved old radio shows, and my dad was nowhere near the age that he would have listened to radio shows, except that he was very poor, and he was the youngest of 10 children. So his brothers and sisters had grown up listening to radio shows. So my dad just did, because that's what they were used to doing, even though it really wasn't part of his life, his generation. Wow. So he's the one who got me kind of hooked on it. And there was a Red Skeleton. It was a story of the Christmas tree. He is the Christmas tree. And I think it was from 1944. It was during World War II. And he talks about Christmas and how people need to come together. And it's the most amazing thing. It makes me cry every time I hear it. It is one of the best radio shows or versions. It was just a piece of a radio show that I've ever heard.
I'm going to have to check it out.
He's the Christmas tree.
I'll check it out someday.
It's amazing.
But we're going way off topic. Let's go back to World of Worlds.
I know. That was really off topic, but that's so weird that you would ask me about Red Skelton, because it's almost like you read my soul talking about him. Yeah. And radio shows at the same time.
Yeah. Well, another cool thing that people don't know is how close we live to each other.
I know.
We're not that far away.
I think you're probably only an hour from me.
If that. I mean, I'm right now, honestly, I am in Escondido, if you know where that's at.
I do. We've went on vacation there, so.
I'm right there, so that's how far I am.
If you ever get a chance, it's called The Littlest Christmas Tree by Red Skelton.
I will check it out, and people listening should check it out too. I'll probably play it sometime during Lyle's Mystery Theater, even though it's probably not mystery, but during Christmas time, I might play it during Christmas time,
you can branch out a little bit.
All right, so some of the things that happened, what were some of the things that happened that made people believe that this was really happening?
I honestly, number one was the news bulletin style that they wrote it in, because they were interrupting the broadcast and building panic as they were going along. Like at first it was just, when they first wrote the script, it was Princeton University Observatory, but the station had taken that out and made it Princeton Observatory, because then it wasn't a real place. And the news bulletins had started with just Princeton Observatory noticing flare-ups on planet Mars that they had never seen before, and then it built from there, where they were discussing, or they were doing news bulletins about gas heading towards Earth at an enormous velocity, and then it built from there to a reporter on the ground where the spaceship / asteroid crashed, and then the reporter on the ground saying that he could see Martians coming out and things like that. So I really think that if people tuned in after that 8:12 p.m. mark, they were only hearing every few minutes a different news bulletin building and building and building the drama in it.
Do you think that a lot of the panic had to do with Germany about to start World War II? Do you think people were in the mindset of, you know, there's a war coming, and then they just happened?
Yeah, and I said earlier that they've done a ton of research. Historians and radio specialists have done a ton of research on this broadcast because of what it did or allegedly did. And they said that 46% of the people thought it was Germans, that the news bulletins were referring to Germans landing in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, not aliens, until they continued to listen. But their first instinct was that Germans had landed.
It's so weird to put Germans and aliens in the same category.
I know, the same context. I know.
I mean, when somebody's freaked out, they're scared, they just finished World War One, and here they're hearing on the radio, they're seeing in the newspaper, Germany is causing a lot of, you know, problems over there. So people were on edge. So this came out at the right time for it to happen.
It definitely did. It was a combination of timing, and the fact that it was Halloween too. People wanted to, you know, preparing to be scared. I think you get in a certain mindset. It's just like how people now in October, suddenly all the ghost walks around different towns and the Queen Mary and Not Scary Farm and all that stuff get huge in October. They could do that year round, but everybody's going to want to go in October. So right. This broadcast, it was a Halloween broadcast. People are prepared to be scared, or wanting to be scared.
They want some scaredness. And yeah. At what point in the broadcast, like pretty much right after the reporter at Grover Mills, when he like died, Orson Welles pretty much just stopped the broadcast, and there was dead silence for a good amount of time. I don't know exactly how long it was, but it was very noticeable that it just went silent.
It was almost a full minute.
Yeah, how genius do you think that was?
Nobody knew what to do. I think everybody expected him. He had said that it was going to be silent. No one expected him to drag it on for that dramatic amount of time, but it was definitely effective.
I think that's probably one of the main things that caused people to panic.
I think it definitely caused people to pause, to be like, "What is this real?"
Right, because the reporter basically just died.
Yeah, they weren't expecting the radio to go silent. Nobody expects a radio to go silent. It's just like when our TVs go silent now, you're like, what's going on?
Yes.
It's the same thing.
But yeah, I mean, we know that the pace was pretty fast. So everything, the story itself, it goes by really fast. You heard it like a couple days ago. So it goes by fast. The pacing's pretty fast. How could that have fooled somebody? Because it seemed like they were at one place and then they were at another and then they were on their way to another place and then they were magically there in a matter of minutes when it should have taken them 20 minutes. How did that fool people?
Well, and that's really funny because John Houseman, who is one of the other directors on it, he's quoted as saying, "Our actual broadcasting time from the first mention of the meteorites to the fall of New York City was less than 40 minutes. During that time, men traveled long distances, large bodies of troops were mobilized, cabinet meetings were held, savage battles were fought on land and in air, and millions of people accepted it, emotionally, if not logically."
Yeah, there's no logic to it. Because I mean, honestly, when you listen to the broadcast, they go, okay, now we're on our way to so-and-so. They have like a little musical interlude for about 30 seconds. Hey, we're there. And we're talking to these people that are standing right here.
And people are like, it's the same again. We take this back again and again. It's the same thing that happens now on social media where, I mean, I lived through the Canyon Fire and it was such a big deal. And if you're reading social media, you would have thought our entire town burned down because people were like, oh, there's a house on fire on this street and there's the house on fire on this street. And then you find out when it's all said and done, no house is actually burned.
Right.
But people are so quick to get their news out. I don't think it's any different than it was back then. And like he said, logically, people knew it could not be happening that quickly. But when you're caught up in that moment, you can't emotionally, you're not there.
Right. Yeah. So we talked about him a little bit. Kenneth Delmar. He was one of the actors. He played the Secretary of Interior, and his delivery when he was doing it, he sounded very. He resembled FDR, the current president. Was this another one of Welles' idea to make him sound like that?
Purposefully, yes, of course. It was it was the realism part of it. It was just like saying Princeton Observatory. It made it real. Having him do that and sound like FDR, people walking in the room wouldn't have known that they introduced him as the Secretary of the Interior.
Right.
They just heard the voice and assumed that it was FDR. I mean, it was the same with the actor who was killed by the Martians, and the way he was screaming and yelling,
right.
He had gone downstairs and listened over and over again to the Hindenburg crash and the recording of that. So he did his entire part of that broadcast was based on the Hindenburg crashing and the reporter that was there.
Yeah, this all the humanity, that's the one that they
exactly
everyone knows that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it just lended to the realism of the broadcast.
Right. Well, we're in the middle of the broadcast, basically, and there's panic happening outside. Were any of the executives, like the CBS executive, were they calling them and telling them, hey, there's, you know, panics going on. You guys need to either stop the broadcast or you need to remind people that this is a story, because there is no reminders that it's a story. Once it starts, once you get that initial reminder in the beginning, hey, we're doing a play, yada, yada. Everything else just sounds real until like the last 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, and that's actually exactly what happened. Their switchboard lit up so dramatically that they started calling actors in that had just finished recording on a different broadcast, a different station. They started grabbing them to help answer the phones to tell people that it wasn't true, because that's the first thing. And I should probably say here, and I don't know if we'll maybe, well, let's talk about the end, but the first thing people did was call the studios. The studios were definitely where we go for we go to social media. Back then they just called the studio and said, what is going on? And so they had operators and things telling them it's just a broadcast, it's not real. But Davidson Taylor had received a telephone call in the control room from who did he get a phone call, sorry, from one of the higher ups in the studio telling him that you got to stop this. You got to tell them that it's not real. Our switchboard is lighting up.
Yeah, and what did Wells do after that? What did he decide to do? Did he decide to stop it?
He just kept going. He kept going. There was nothing that was going to stop that man from that moment forward. He had a show to do. He had a plan for the show. I don't think he realized at the time the magnitude of what would happen, but he wasn't going to stop it. It was part of his show. That was the point of the show, was to make it as real as he could make it.
Yeah, so at the time that the station break actually came around, people were still panicking. Like, after that, why would they still panic? Couldn't they just look outside and see that nothing was going on?
I guess in certain places you could, but if you were, say you were on the California coast and they're talking about Grover's Mill in New York, you couldn't walk outside and see that nothing was happening. You probably walk outside and see your neighbors walking outside going, what's happening? I don't think it just, there wasn't the communication there is now, or the ability to communicate the way that you can now. And it was dramatized. The way the studio reacted and the phone calls that were coming in, I don't think there wasn't the level of panic that they portrayed it to be, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, the last 20 minutes or so, the broadcast, you can tell that it was a story because basically the world ended. The last 20 minutes is basically
there was nothing left.
Yeah, Wells, Wells's character pretty much is, you know, giving the, oh yeah, the world ended, and then, you know, the Martians died. So he reveals at the very end that this is just a Halloween offering, as he put it. Do you think that he actually intended it for it to start a panic, or do you think he was very like, oh yeah, this was just supposed to be a Halloween prank, it's not supposed to be anything big, but people still took it in a panic?
I don't know. I definitely think he knew what he was doing.
I think so too.
I don't think he knew the magnitude of it.
Right. Yeah. I have the same feeling. I don't think he really knew what was going on outside of his, you know, personal bubble. But there was a huge panic out there. I don't think he really intended it for it to go that far.
I don't think there was intention there, but I do believe that he was okay with it.
Oh, I'm sure. But we'll get into the we'll get into the aftermath in the next episode. So for now, we're going to go ahead and end part two of the World of the World discussion, the broadcast itself. So when we come back tomorrow, we're going to talk about the aftermath. You guys, stay tuned.